accession number 8337, reel 5.
General Graham, reel 5. How much help did you get from, on the one hand, the Arabs in Palestine, and on the other hand, the Turkish Cypriots in Cyprus, in fighting against your opponents?
As a soldier, I personally got no help at all from the Arabs in Palestine, but I have no doubt at all that the government, and of course the Palestine police and the CID and special branch and so on, got a great deal. And we obviously got the spin-off from that, but I can't identify any Arabs that definitely helped us. In Cyprus, we got more help from Greeks than is generally recognised. I've hinted at this before. The Turks, very little. The Turks were 25% of the population, and they were very much second-class citizens. And they kept themselves to themselves. We could, of course, go through their villages with impunity, but they didn't have much information to give us, or if they did, there was also the question of communication. How did a Turkish-speaking chap communicate with a Scotsman?
As far as the help which Greeks gave you, is it possible to identify any social or political groups amongst the Greeks who would be more likely to give information to the British Army?
Not groups, but individuals. There were a number of individuals, some in really quite high positions, for whom we had the greatest respect, who had the interests of their country, Cyprus, at heart, and were looking not a fortnight ahead, but 10, 20 years ahead, and knew what the consequences of Ennis's, or the campaign for Ennis's, would be. And they were extremely brave and highly respected by us because they put their lives, of course, in jeopardy in the service of their country.
Was there the same bitterness towards EOKA as there was towards Irgun Zvailumi and the other organisations in Palestine?
I think it's very similar. Very similar. The British soldiers that I was lucky enough to command really came to dislike the Jewish terrorists very much because of the barbaric tactics, the dressing up as Arabs and blowing up hotels, the booby-trapping of bodies, the deceit that a terrorist has to indulge in if he's going to fight an occupying army. EOKA, they indulged not so much in outright attacks against us as against shooting women and children in the back. And there was a rash of assassinations, you remember, in Cyprus. Ledra Street was a particularly notorious area when the odd British soldier, but particularly British wives out shopping, would be shot in the back. Now, this caused the soldiers in Cyprus to get very angry, and of course the public at home. And it was very interesting, in fact, that I went from Edinburgh, leaving my family there, to Cyprus, when this sort of campaign of shooting in the back was at its height. And the English papers were full of it. And indeed, one didn't really know, on leaving Scotland to go to Cyprus, what the risks were going to be. One's families were quite worried because it seemed to be a daily occurrence. All I can say is that having got to Cyprus, we find these to be really rather rare occurrences. And I never felt in particular danger the whole time as I was in Cyprus. There was the odd ambush, but nothing particularly professional. Nor did we lose many people.
Which unit were you with in Cyprus, actually?
1st Argyles.
And which places did you operate in?
We started off in the northwest corner of Cyprus at a town called Limni. And then after some months there, we moved right across to the Larnaca area to a large barracks in or near Dhekelia. And the families joined us. I mean, EOKA was beaten and it became much safer. And we had a fairly peaceful time down there. The hotbed was really Nicosia and some villages to the north. Kyrene and the Panhandle, I think, was difficult, although I wasn't called on to operate there much.
Did you actually see any of the people who were captured?
I suppose I saw a few suspects, yes. But, of course, it wasn't a war. I mean, people who were found acting as terrorists or thought to be terrorists were merely handed over to the police and were dealt with civilly. There was no question of military rule.
Can you describe a typical daily routine that you would have to perform whilst you were in Cyprus?
When we were in Limni, the daily routine was almost continuous operations. Roadblocks, searching areas, checking on culverts, checking on buildings for arms caches. Yes, fairly intensive operations, not particularly hazardous. The worst event, which occurred just before I got there, was the Gordons were doing an operation in a forest which caught fire. It either caught fire or the terrorists set it on fire and the wind got up and I think 16 Gordons were killed just by a forest fire. That was very unpleasant. But the casualties inflicted on us as an army by IOKA were not all that great. As I say, more on women and children.
What about contact with the civilian population? Was there much fraternization?
More than there had been in Palestine.
Why do you think that was?
By the time we got to the Kalia, the tempo of operations had died down because IOKA had been, to a great extent, defeated. There had, I think, talks had started between Athens and Ankara and London. And as I say, the tempo reduced, and one went shopping, and there was more sort of fraternization in restaurants and so on. Life was returning to normalcy. As I say, the families came and joined us there. Would and we lived in Greek Cypriot houses in a Greek Cypriot population.
Would it be fraternization with the Greeks rather than the Turks?
I think so. Because the Turks could play a very small part in our lives. You see, when I talk about fraternization, I'm not talking about drinks parties, because that didn't really occur. I'm talking about normal social intercourse, shopping, drinking coffee, getting taxis, going to beaches, this sort of thing. And the Greeks were there, 75% of the population. And the Turks were much more peasant-like and withdrawn and isolated. There was no cause to actually fraternize with them.
Could you tell a Greek from a Turkish Cypriot?
Oh, yes, normally. Different stature, different build, different colouring. And, of course, you could see that, I mean, in their farms and their cafes, the Turkish language letters were there, as opposed to Greek writing.
What was the difference in stature?
Oh, I think the Turk was a much more robust chap, much thicker set. A slightly different shaped head, less Mediterranean, less Latin.
What did British troops marry Cypriot girls during this period?
I'm sure they did, but I have no recollection of it. Don't think any of mine did. But I'm sure some, for instance, in the Ordnance Corps and the Service Corps, or the Royal Air Force, were stationed there in a more static position for much longer, probably did in years. Yes, I think so. Very small numbers, but I'm sure it happened. They're very attractive, some of them.
What did the British Army think of Archbishop Makarios?
Well, he was regarded, of course, as the arch-enemy, the wicked bishop, from whom Grievous and his thugs drew their political support and their financial support. And indeed, the Greek priesthood was regarded with great suspicion because the monasteries, we thought, were sort of hotbeds of sanctuaries for the terrorists and so on. To what extent this is true, I simply can't tell you. But Makarios undoubtedly was a very popular leader for the Greek Cypriots. So much so he had been banished. He was banished, I think, to the Seychelles.
More popular than Grivas?
Oh, I think so. Yes, yes.
How did that show itself? With portraits or something like that?
Yes, protected portraits. Images. And coverage in the popular press.
What did the attitude of the fairly strong Communist Party on Cyprus seem to be towards this situation?
I have no personal experience of the Communist Party. We knew it was there. And when we asked this question of the diplomats and others who should have known, the answer we tended to get, and I'm sure it is the correct one, was the Communist Party of Cyprus or wherever, like any Communist Party, was actually there to serve its own ends. And it did not have a consistent policy in either backing the Turks or EUCA per se, but it acted entirely in its own interests at a given moment.
You didn't come across any conflict between communists and EUCA, for example?
Not that I can recollect, but I'm sure there were occasions on which it broke out because they had different aims. Now, some of the things I've said during the last five reels about the British Army and its expertise in contradistinction with, say, the German members of the Wehrmacht or the Jewish terrorists or EUCA may lead you to think that I believe the British soldier could have done better. I think this is perfectly true. I think we could have all have done better. I think we did very well. I think that our training, with hindsight, could have concentrated more on the basic essentials of the battlefield. I think more could have been demanded of us. I hadn't been in Normandy very long before, as I told you earlier. I became, like all my colleagues, so aware of the need to understand what was a hostile shell or bullet coming towards you and what was an innocuous one. I remember saying to myself time and time again when digging a slit trench or when trawling, if only I'd practiced this more, but we didn't. And you know, it's particularly important for the more senior you become. Because if you're going to do a battle, if you're going to plan a battle, somebody has got to go and make a plan. And you can't make a plan until you've seen the ground. And if you're going to look at a piece of ground which the enemy are defending, you can't just walk to the top of a tree or a church tower and look down with a map and say, we're going to do this and you're going to do that and the enemy's going to do something else. It's a pretty bloody tiresome business. And when you get quite elderly officers, I'm talking about people who are in their early 30s, commanding battalions and companies, having to crawl up hedgerows, as we did, for example, on one memorable occasion at Point 112 before Green Line, that operation I was telling you from Baron. after about 25 yards of crawling with binoculars and map cases and weapons and pack and all these things, unless you're pretty skilled at it and practice, you get a bit knackered. It is these things which I remember so well and which I endeavoured to instil in my subordinates in the years following in peacetime soldiering. And I think in the parachute regiment in particular, it paid off. I mean, we got the message and did these things as a matter of course. Marching, too. We used to do in Normandy, through shortage of transport, a lot of marching. But, of course, as the army became modernised, we do more and more in APCs and in four-ton lorries and less marching. This, I think, is an error, because the time is going to come in any future battlefield when the transport would have been destroyed or can't move, and as in the Falklands, the infantry have got to get out and they've got to be able to carry their kit and their ammunition and what remains of their destroyed equipment and so on, very considerable distances through very rough country. We're losing the technique. We don't do it enough. The other thing I must say is that up to the time I left Cyprus, the infantry, like most of the army, was basically a conscript army. And people have often said to me, oh, weren't you glad when the conscripts went and you just had nothing but regular soldiers? All I can say is in the companies of our guards that I commanded, in my last months in Cyprus, I should think one third were regular or wishing to stay on. The other two thirds were conscripts just waiting their time to go. I denoted no unwillingness or lack of enthusiasm or lack of keenness on the part of the conscript at all. They pulled their weight very well. And there was no marked change in discipline or anything else when they went and we became all regular. I think the ordinary guy who was conscripted into the services pulled his weight remarkably well. And I think if there were any weaknesses on the part of the conscript soldiers who fought with us through Normandy, and then in Palestine, and then in Cyprus, it can be attributed to two things. One is, and I've touched on this, perhaps a slightly soft approach to training. It could have been harder. It ought to have been made harder. And I think our national tolerance of casualties should be a little more robust. And the second thing is the equipment. Certainly in Normandy, against the Germans with their equipment, we were less well equipped. Our tanks, our personal weapons, and our webbing was not as good as the German army was equipped with.
Do you think, as far as conscripts are concerned, that they may have brought something to the army which it lacked before?
Oh, I think undoubtedly. I think certainly there was a degree of intelligence and a sort of refreshing outlook, and a degree of common sense and imaginative powers, which is very good for an army. Yes, I do.
What did you mean when you said earlier about a more robust attitude towards casualties?
Well, suffering all casualties is grievous, whether you know the individual intimately and personally or not. But I think there is no doubt that a unit in the British infantry that had been engaged for 3 days and suffered, let us say, 100 casualties, killed and wounded, or disappeared, was regarded as being no longer fit for battle and had to be withdrawn and rested and brought back, you know, to a safe place. On the other side of the hill, in the German army, not only, of course, did they start with far fewer officers than we had. I mean, it was quite normal towards the end of the campaign for German battalions to be run by 3 officers and for the NCOs to carry a much greater weight. But the number of killed and wounded, which they expected themselves to suffer before they surrendered a piece of ground, was of quite a different order to ourselves. Quite a different order. And I remember in that long flog from the Falaise Gap up into Belgium, taking prisoner myself in a town called St. Paul, a German company sergeant major, and he had in his hand an exercise book. And in the most immaculate handwriting, he had kept a nominal roll of all the people who had passed through his company in the last 2 or 3 months. I let him keep it, but I looked at it. There were, I suppose, 5 pages of wounded, 20 lines to a page. There were 2.5 to 3 pages of dead. And this is what really shook me. There was rather more than 0.5 page of headed Selbstmord, suicide. Now, that gives an indication of the weight of fire and the general nastiness which we, with our backing, threw at them, and which, by and large, they stood up to, and of an order which we never received ourselves except on the rarest occasion, such as Arnhem. or perhaps a barrel, as I was telling you.
Now, in 1970, you got a posting to Oman. Can you tell me how that posting came about?
Yes, I can. It came about because in the years 63 to 65, I was with the parachute brigade units based in Bahrain as part of the United Kingdom Defence Agreement with Kuwait, in which we kept an airborne force in readiness at Bahrain and in Aden to support the Kuwaitis should they be threatened again by Iraq or any other power. And during my initial time with the 2nd Parachute Battalion and thereafter in command of the 1st Parachute Battalion Group in Bahrain, we used to go down to Oman for parachute and amphibious exercises. And during these visits, lasted perhaps a week or 10 days, I felt myself becoming very attached to the geography and the people and the feel of the country. Furthermore, I had some family experience of the Gulf because an uncle of mine had commanded the Royal Naval Detachments in the Persian Gulf during World War II, and of course from him, before he died, I heard a number of stories and became interested in the area. So it was with great pleasure that in late 69, when I was told I was being promoted to the rank of brigadier and was given the choice of the commanding the forces in Oman, in the appointment of CSAF, Commander of the Sultan's Armed Forces, CSAF for short, or another appointment in the rank of brigadier in England, I most willingly chose to be sent to Oman. And I arrived there at the end of March in 1970, having done an 11-week Arabic course at the educational centre at Beaconsfield.
You say attachment to the country, but one always thinks of it as a very hot and barren sort of country.
I know people do. In fact, it is a very varied country. I think the best adjective to apply to the Sultanate, Oman, is majestic. I find it a most majestic country, inhabited by some very fine people, who have incidentally been known to the English as the gentlemen of the Gulf area, since this term was first used by an Englishman called Buckingham some 150 years ago. Now, the terrain is certainly very varied. There is remarkably little desert, in fact. The north part of the country, and the whole country, I must say, is approximate the size of the United Kingdom, with a population of a give or take 1 million. The north part of the country and the central area is dominated by that huge range of mountains, the Hajar Range, of which the key peak is the Jebel Akhtar, the Green Mountain, which rises to 10,000 feet. And on the summit of which there is from time to time snow, and in which constantly there is water and the most marvellous selection of fruits. On the west side of this Hajar Range, there lies the deserts, which flow, of course, into Saudi Arabia and become the empty quarter. But to the eastern side, there is a fairly narrow gravel plain with a very significant water table underneath. And then, of course, the coastal strip, the Batana coast.
Which coast?
Batana. And all these mountains and the coastal strip take up the majority of what is now known as the Sultanate of Oman. But as we go further south, there becomes an area of pure desert, the Harassis Desert, about 300 kilometres wide. And it is this desert which separates Oman proper from the province of Dhofar. Now, Dhofar province, about the size of Wales, is quite different to the rest of the Arabian Gulf, because you see, Dhofar province runs not north-south, but east-west along the Indian Ocean, and for 5 months of the year is subject to the monsoon. Now, the monsoon has two effects. The first is, of course, that the sea becomes extremely rough between May and September, which makes it very difficult for any ship to land anything or take on stores without the benefit of a protected harbour, a specially constructed harbour. The other point is that from May until September, the terrain is covered up to quite a significant distance in from the coast by a continuous Scotch mist. It varies from day to day in thickness, but it is there. And, of course, this wetness produces marvellous fertility. So at the end of the monsoon, come late September, early October, the mountains of Dhofar, that great crescent of hills, about 3,000 feet high, which it forms the backcloth to the coastal plain and the capital city of Salalah, looks rather like Salisbury Plain, with long green grass and fine cattle, and goats, and camels. It is very fertile. Now, the combination of Dhofar and the Harris's Desert and the mountains of the north with their fruit and their dates and other things such as copper give Oman a diversity of terrain and a wealth of natural resources which most of the Gulf or the Arabian Peninsula states themselves lack.
You say that the Omanis were described as the gentlemen of the area. What specifically does that mean?
Courtesy, manners, attitude to life, pride, very proud people, self-discipline. They are, I believe, and all my British colleagues, without exception, agree with me on this. They are a very fine people. They have, of course, had a wonderful history. When you think that Zohar, which is a town about three quarters of the way up the Bathana coast, I think in the 13th century, was the greatest seaport in the Mohammedan world. And their record at sea and crossing the oceans as mariners, the record of the Omanis is very great. They travelled as far as China and Hong Kong and Singapore, commonplace. Their seafaring abilities were very marked. And this, of course, meant that the whole development of the country was influenced by things that they had seen and brought back from far afield. And, of course, as you probably know, there was a long period in Omani history when, of course, much of the east coast of Africa, including Zanzibar, was in fact under the control of the ruling family in Oman.
Was there anything you didn't like about the Omanis?
Very little, and I find it remarkably difficult to put my finger on it. Some of the servants were idle, I suppose, but in terms of trustworthiness and so on, I find them admirable. And indeed, I would say, and many of us say, that it's when you come back from Oman to our own country, our own Western society, it is there that you find the flaws and begin to feel disappointments and, to a certain extent, shame. Attitude to litter, attitude to work, attitude to discipline, attitude to religion. We have lost a number of the qualities, which I think in great part the Omanis still retain. There is another theory I have as to why the Omanis should be so noticeably different in character and outlook and physique to those of the other tribes in the Arabian Gulf.